Sometimes the people most affected by police shootings are the children of victims.
No one really wanted to talk to me about it too much. I think everyone kind of just tried to put it in the back of their minds. It was always, oh, well, the police killed him. I never knew too many details about my father's death. I kind of had to find those out on my own.
I'm Arun Venugopal in for Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for Thursday, September 10th, the long-lasting effects of police shootings on children. Also, a new investigation on how there may have been a shady quid pro quo between the Trump administration and Guatemala's former president. Then, with tomorrow marking the 19th anniversary of the 9/11 terror attacks, we hear a fresh examination of the global events leading up to that moment.
Now we can explain the way the Afghan War, which raged in Afghanistan throughout the 1980s, was the perfect opportunity, funded by the CIA, for these radical jihadists to get to know each other.
But first, how politicians need to take advantage of this moment to fight for policies for racial justice. On Wednesday, mainstream news was dominated by coverage of new revelations surrounding President Trump's mishandling of the pandemic. In a conversation the president had with journalist Bob Woodward back on February 7th, Trump emphasized the severity of the coronavirus.
You know, it's a very tricky situation. It's
it goes
through air, Bob. That's always tougher than the touch. You know, the touch, you don't have to touch things, right? But the air, you just breathe the air, and that's how it's passed. And so that's a very tricky one. That's a very delicate one. It's also more deadly than your strenuous flus.
But the president has consistently downplayed the threat in public.
I really think, Doctor, you want to treat this like you treat the flu, right?
We think we have it very well under control.
We pretty much shut it down.
A lot of people think that goes away in April with the heat. We're in very good shape.
This is hardly the first reporting detailing how the Trump administration has misled the public during the pandemic. But this latest information comes to light as the country's death toll from COVID-19 is now over 190,000, with black and brown people still dying at much higher rates. Meanwhile, in a piece published by The Atlantic yesterday, staff writer Adam Serwer focused on what he sees as President Trump's failures in another area, responding to the summer's racial justice uprising. According to Serwer, Trump has misread the moment by continuing to make racist appeals to his base of white Americans. Those comments have included painting demonstrators as radicals and emphasizing calls to restore law and order. And because polling from over the summer indicated that a majority of the U.S. population supported the racial justice movement, the president's divisive approach might not be so effective this time around. Serwer looks in his new piece at different turning points around civil rights in U.S. history. And he finds some lessons for policymakers to keep in mind if they truly want to capitalize on public support for racial equality right now. Adam Serwer is on the line with me now to talk about his new article. Adam, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
You say that President Trump misread the moment, that the support among a majority of Americans is much greater than he may have anticipated when he, I guess, dug in his heels against Black Lives Matter. Are you surprised by the moment and the willingness or the support that Americans have for Black Lives Matter?
Well, first of all, I was surprised, but I also want to emphasize the video of George Floyd begging for his life while the police essentially stand on his neck and do nothing. I think it really deeply affected a lot of people, but it wasn't the only thing that affected a lot of people. These videos have been coming out for many years now, and I think that Americans have slowly shifted their perceptions about the reality of racially discriminatory policing and racism itself in the United States. And the polls still show that, even though there have been polls that have shown some decline in support for Black Lives Matter, Americans are generally sort of sticking to the realization that racism still deeply shapes American life. And the president's response was essentially, he only really ever has one solution to problems, which is violence. He's either trying to intimidate someone to get them to shut up, or he's threatening to use state force against them. And that's been true since the 2016 campaign, when he said he wanted to ban Muslims, or he said, you know, he was going to do mass deportation or build a wall to prevent undocumented immigrants from coming in, you know, when he sent troops to the border. So there's nothing really particularly out of character about the president responding to racial justice protests by, it emphasizing that police in at one point, even the military should respond with an iron fist. It just wasn't where the country was because they recognized, even though the protesters sometimes did things that they didn't like, they recognized the justice of the cause that they were advocating for, which is that people should not be mistreated by armed agents of the state who are paid with taxpayer dollars. They should have the same rights as everyone else.
You try to make some connection. Well, you do make connections, not between today and an era that a lot of people like to look at, 1968, the chaos at that time in the late 60s, but a much earlier era, which is Reconstruction, and the parallels you see between then and now. What are some of the notable connections?
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of commentators making comparisons between Nixon 1968 and Trump's campaign now because they're both using the phrase law and order. But Nixon's law and order was an attempt at triangulation. George Wallace was running at the time, and his rhetoric about shooting people who were looting and stuff like that. His rhetoric was much closer to Trump's rhetoric in the sense that it was in advocating the use of state violence against protesters and collapsing all the protesters, whether peaceful or otherwise, into radicals that needed to be put down with armed force. Nixon's law and order was both saying, I'm going to suppress civil rights protests, but I'm also not going to let lawless white supremacists engage in violence. And that really hasn't been Trump's message. Trump's message has been much closer to that of Andrew Johnson in 1868, which was basically, this is your country and I'm going to keep it your country, and that's why you should stick with me. You know, 1866 to 1868, after the Civil War, most Americans, they really just sort of wanted to get out on with their lives. They didn't want to enact an expansive program of racial justice. But because of the reports of violence in the South against the emancipated and the sheer amount of volume of information coming out about how black people were being mistreated after being freed from slavery, the North ended up becoming radicalized and doing more than they intended to do at the beginning of Reconstruction. They embedded the 14th and 15th Amendments into the Constitution. They essentially inscribed the racial equality into the Constitution where it didn't exist before. And I think the way that this moment is comparable, or at least could be comparable, is that you've never really seen this many Americans on board with the racial justice project. You certainly didn't see it in the 1960s when protests, like, despite the fact that we celebrate them now, Martin Luther King was not very popular in the 1960s. The March on Washington was not popular in the 1960s. People generally said that these protests were counterproductive and they were hurting the cause of black rights. And now we sort of think of them as heroic moments. So what's extraordinary, actually, is that public opinion is so much on the side of the racial justice protesters compared to previous points in time. And I do think one thing that has to do with it is that, you know, when Barack Obama got elected, I think a lot of people assume that we were, if not, and I don't think very many people assume we were a post-racial country, but a lot of people felt like we were on the right track to finally eradicating racism from American public life. And then, you know, we elected Donald Trump, whose rise to political prominence was rooted in his willingness to spread the slander that the first black president was not born in the United States and has pursued a raft of discriminatory policies across the board, from vocally encouraging police brutality to his travel ban targeting Muslim travelers to his crackdown on immigration. I think has the combination of these cell phone videos of police mistreatment of black Americans coming out over and over and over again, and the fact that the president himself has espoused ideas about race and citizenship that we once thought were no longer a part of American political life, has radicalized a lot of people who were previously, I think, inclined to dismiss racism as not a serious problem in America anymore.
In your Atlantic article, you quote W.E.B. Du Bois, who referred to Reconstruction as, quote, seven mystic years, and went on to say, while after long years the American world recovered in most matters, it is never yet quite understood why it could ever have thought that black men were altogether human. I'm wondering, are you more mystified by the ability of Americans to cling to white supremacy or to actually be able to recognize the humanity of black people?
Look, the central paradox of the United States is that it is a country founded by slaveholders on the principle that all are created equal. And we've been struggling with the two sides of that principle is America a country of white Christian men, and must the country always belong to that particular group of people, or is this a country for everyone regardless of race, creed, color, or religion? Again, we've been struggling with that for hundreds of years. It would be arrogant to assume that we're going to stop anytime soon. So I don't think that it's unusual. I think the significance of the Du Bois quote is that sometimes there are moments where people have great awakenings about this stuff and great progress is possible. But these moments are typically followed by forms of backlash in which that pursuit of racial equality is walked backwards. And I suspect that, you know, if the country doesn't act soon to capitalize on the sentiment, the reality is that it will subside eventually.
You talk about the radical Republicans of the 1800s. When you look at the current moment, do you see a critical mass of white radicals analogous to those Republicans who were helping, I guess, push for racial equality?
I actually don't see very many white radicals at all. What I see is there are millions of white Americans who have been radicalized in the sense that they previously did not see racism as a huge problem, but now are awakening to the reality of how much it still shapes American life for people of color and black people in particular. I think what's perhaps interesting is that when you look back at the composition of the country in 1868 or in 1968, we're a much more diverse country now. And that means that there's a much larger population of Americans who have a stake in anti-racism and anti-discrimination because their lives are shaped by prejudice. And I think that is a new possibility, a new component to this moment that didn't previously exist and may mean that politicians end up being more responsive to these demands than they might have been.
A lot of this for you hinges on the election, doesn't it, simply put?
Well, I mean, I don't expect Donald Trump to pursue an expansive program of racial justice if elected. And I think that it would be unexpected if Joe Biden did, given his past record, but it also wouldn't be entirely far-fetched given the composition of the Democratic Party on this moment and its reliance on the votes of people of color and black voters in particular.
So among white Democrats, it's one thing to say they support Black Lives Matter, another thing entirely to support specific policies that address racial inequality. Are there certain ones that you think are really, I guess, beyond the pale for certain people who want to say that they are, you know, Black Lives Matter, but aren't willing to really go to the mat?
You know, historically, the policies that have tended to be pursued are those that have a combination of effect on racial equality and partisan self-interest. So it was certainly the case that the Republicans in the 1860s wanted to enfranchise black people because they understood that the Republican Party could not be viable in the South without black votes. And I think there's something similar to that here in the sense that I would be, if the Democrats win, I very much expect them to pursue a voting rights agenda pretty quickly because they know that they have to protect their own voters from what they see as an agenda of voter disenfranchisement from the Republican Party. Where these movements typically run against the most resistance is in questions of economic redistribution. And that was true in the 1860s when radicals like Thaddeus Stevens were arguing that the Confederate estates of wealthy planters should be broken up and given to former slaves to till as small farms. That proposal went nowhere because most Republicans opposed it, not just Democrats. And in general, white Americans have been really resistant to engage in the kind of economic redistribution that economists believe would be necessary to actually address the racial wealth gap. That gives you sort of an idea of the kind of measures that might be able to be pursued. And I think police reform is difficult for a number of reasons, but it sort of lies in between those two poles.
Thaddeus Stevens was he's kind of an extraordinary figure, wasn't he, for his time?
Yeah, I mean, he was an extraordinary figure for his time in the sense that he was a genuine believer in racial equality. And he was also a kind of, an early progressive in the sense that he really did believe that concentrated wealth posed a threat to democracy and saw breaking up of the planters' estates not just as a reward for the emancipated for their uncompensated labor, but that he just felt that this concentration of wealth made the construction of a democratic society in the South impossible. And I think that observation holds a tremendous amount of relevance for our current situation today, where economic inequality is such that almost all the gains of the since the 1970s have been concentrated in the top of the income bracket. And I think that has had as much of an eroding effect on our democracy today as Thaddeus Stevens predicted it would have in the South, 150 years ago.
Given how violent the Civil War was, and the extent of, anger amongst Northerners towards Southerners, why wasn't there more support for breaking up these plantations and redistributing land to Black Americans?
Well, I think that Americans, by and large, back then, the prevailing ideology was one of free labor, was one in which capital and labor were working together in harmony, and the laborer would work and prosper and then become an entrepreneur and therefore rise in station, and that this was the way that the economy was supposed to work. Now, it couldn't work that way in the South because white Southerners prevented any effort at accumulating wealth or economic influence by the emancipated through any means necessary, whether violence, whether refusing to send them land, whether refusing to let them unionize, refusing to allow them to borrow capital to start businesses. So there's simply no way for Black Americans in the South right after the Civil War to rise through the free labor model. But I think in general, Americans are very ideologically, classically liberal in the sense that they are offended by the idea of racial discrimination and people being denied opportunities because of their race. But I think they are actually, somewhat wary of the idea that you should redistribute income. And I think that's why, there's an entire political party that exists today, the Republican Party, to prevent that from happening. And to redistribute income upward. So I think that, the reality is that Americans tend to be very resistant to the kind of expansive taxation that would be needed to fund the kind of generous social welfare programs that you see, say, in Europe.
Even if President Trump holds on to power in November, we see another 4 years, a second Trump administration, do you see sort of, at the state level, at more local level, do you see the possibility of more progressive change happening, or does it really hinge largely on what happens at the top?
I don't think it hinges on what happens at the top. In particular, the things that activists want to do to change policing that is largely a local fight. It'll be a difficult local fight because police unions and prosecutors have a tremendous amount of political power in these jurisdictions, but they have had a lot of success so far at putting more progressive DAs in office who have said that they're not going to pursue low-level drug crimes, for example, and they're going to pursue more lenient policies. I think if Trump gets elected, and I think that this is really important, no one, including the Trump campaign, believes that if the president is reelected, that he is going to be reelected with a majority of the vote. It will be because he wins in the Electoral College. And I think that's significant. It obviously, the popular vote doesn't determine who wins, but it's significant in the sense that the president's agenda and his presence in the office is counter to what most of the American people actually want. And that sort of counter-majoritarianism necessarily delegitimizes whatever pursuit the president would choose to take. Now,
but that's what happened in 2016.
I have to say, I don't know what's going to happen in November. Perhaps the president will defy the expectations and win the Electoral College and the popular vote, in which case, what I've just said is moot. But I think, one of the things I want to emphasize in my piece is that the president is wielding, or I emphasize in my piece is that the president is wielding power on behalf of these ideas, in opposition to how most of the American people feel.
But that's what happened in 2016, right? The scenario you laid out, it's possible that he wins the Electoral College, but loses a popular vote. he's governed for 4 years with that exact scenario.
Yes, and it's made him pretty unpopular. I mean, when his approval rating has been low for almost his entire presidency, and consistently low, because he is not actually governed as though he, as president of the United States, has civic obligations towards people who did not vote for him. Mm-hmm. When you look at the response to the coronavirus around the world, even in countries that did not handle the coronavirus particularly well, the status of their leaders rose in part because those leaders were capable of expressing empathy for those who were affected. The president has viewed himself as the primary victim of the coronavirus pandemic because he sees it as having harmed his chances of being reelected. And so his approval rating, after a very small rally effect early in the beginning of the pandemic, has dissipated to where it was normally. In some sense, the president and his supporters have legitimized his hold on power by telling themselves that they're the only real Americans, and that the only people who can wield power legitimately are those who have their approval, like Donald Trump. But that is fundamentally not how democracies are supposed to work. In a democracy, every vote is supposed to count the same, and it's not supposed to matter who you are.
Adam Serwer is a staff writer at The Atlantic. Adam, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Last month, Jacob Blake was shot multiple times by police in Kenosha, Wisconsin, as his three young children watched from inside his car just several feet away. In 2016, another black man, Philando Castile, was killed by police in Minnesota during a traffic stop. His girlfriend's four-year-old daughter was in the back seat. In 2019, a Tatiana Jefferson was fatally shot by police in her home in Fort Worth, Texas, in front of her 8-year-old nephew. Children, especially black children, have long not just been victims of police violence in the U.S., as in the case of 12-year-old Tamir Rice, but witnesses too. And the impact of losing a parent or another family member to police violence can have serious consequences on a child, both in the immediate aftermath of the incident, but also in the longer term, from developing mental health conditions like PTSD or depression to poor performance in school. Today we hear from just one of countless people who have lost parents or other loved ones to police violence in the U.S. Montanique Monroe is a freelance journalist based in Austin, Texas. Her father, Paul Monroe, was killed by police on April 15, 1993, when she was just 4 months old. Montanique, thank you for joining us.
Hi, Aaron. I'm so happy to speak with you today.
So tell us about your dad, Paul, and what happened to him.
Yeah, so the only knowledge that I have of who my father was is based off of what my family members have told me. And so I know that he was a funny guy. He was goofy. You couldn't mm-hmm. stay mad at him too long because he would always make you laugh. Mm-hmm. He was a provider for his family. One of the stories that sticks with me the most is one that my grandmother always tells me. And it's about a little boy who had come over our house after my father had passed away. And the little boy was crying because he said that my father had been bringing him and his siblings groceries every week because his parents weren't in the home. And so that just kind of goes to show the kind of person my father was. He had a bright smile. He was very goal-oriented, very driven. And my uncle the other day told me that I was at Sonic with my uncle, and he told me I had ordered a large ocean water. It's actually my favorite drink. And okay. So he was like, wow, that's your dad's favorite. That was favorite drink. Yeah. So little things and little stories come out about my father every now and then. But all I know about him is just a few little things that I hear from family members that come out at, different moments, unfortunately.
Yeah. Yeah.
Everything
yeah.
else I kind of just make up in my head.
You fill the spaces.
Yeah.
So you wrote about him for Vox and also about what happened, this confrontation, this very mysterious and tragic confrontation between him and police officers. Can you describe what happened?
Yeah. So my father was allegedly involved in an armed robbery on April 15th, 1993. And as he exited the apartment complex at the scene, he was met by three officers. And as he walked toward them, They gave him directions to drop a duffel bag. He dropped the bag. He was directed to get on the ground. And before he was able to get on the ground, he was shot by police officer Stephen Deaton. And there were two other officers there at the scene who did not fire their weapons at my father. And so growing up, I had always been kind of interested in what happened to my dad. I learned about his death when I was like 6 years old. And so I had so many questions, and I would visit these albums that my family would have, and these albums would chronicle his life from his death. It was filled with photos. It was filled with news articles. One of the articles was titled "Man's Death Brings Confusion." Mm-hmm. And so I would read these articles, and it would never add up as to why my father was killed.
You're seeing these things, clearly raising these questions in a fairly young child.
Yeah.
Did you ask your family members about this?
Yeah, so I would ask questions, and no one really wanted to talk to me about it too much. I think everyone kind of just tried to put it in the back of their minds. It was always, oh, well, the police killed him. I never knew too many details about my father's death. I kind of had to find those out on my own. And so I avoided the details because it was just too traumatizing and triggering for me to like really know like what my father went through and to know that he was killed by police. And so I really honestly didn't find out the graphic details until adulthood.
And there's a couple particularly painful details that you found out about, I guess, presumably when you were old enough to grasp what was happening. What were those details that you think of really kind of like, I guess, stayed with you and affected you?
So there was a 50-something page incident report that my grandmother had kept for like the past 27 years. She kept literally every document related to my dad's death. And I was kind of forced to go through it after news surfaced that the officer who killed my father had made racist, sexist Facebook posts. And so once I found that out, I was like, okay, I need to figure out read this report and see what really happened to my father. And so just reading that account was very gut-wrenching, and it makes me tear up just thinking about it now. Like my father, he asked for water after they shot him and they wouldn't give him water. He was telling the officer, I can't feel my legs, I can't see, kind of inquiring like, why'd you shoot me? He didn't exactly say those words, but you could tell like reading the officer's testimony that my father was just really confused as to why he was shot. And so I read about how he was rushed to the hospital, and at the hospital on his deathbed, officers came in and tried to interview him about what just happened to him, and they took pictures of him. And so it was just nothing about what happened to my father on that day seems right. And I literally think about this every single day of my life. So it's been hard.
Yeah, I can't even imagine. We've seen this incredible resurgence of activism against police brutality and systemic racism this summer, really kind of revolving around Black men and women who are killed by police officers. Of course, George Floyd is the first person to come to mind this year, but so many more, some names we know, some that we don't. What has this moment meant for how you think about your father's death?
Oh my gosh, that's such a good question. I mean, anytime a person is killed by law enforcement and it is broadcasted on national television and is broadcasted and replayed on social media, it kind of brings back up all the emotions that I feel when I think about my father. And it's kind of like a re-traumatization of like reliving what my father went through type of situation. But George Floyd specifically has allowed me to tell my father's story. I had been trying to tell my father's story for so long. I felt like both me and my father had been living in the shadows, that Stephen Deaton, the police officer who killed him, had just moved on with his life and was able to, continue his career in law enforcement for 26 plus years while, my family, our lives were kind of put on pause. And so I really wanted to bring awareness to my father's death. by telling a story. As a journalist, I know that you have to have some type of angle in order to do that. And my similarities or commonality with Gianna, George Floyd's daughter, is what really has allowed me to use my voice and kind of speak from the angle of the child's perspective and how, as a child, when you lose a parent, it really affects you. And my story isn't the same as Gianna. She actually knew her father, George. Mm-hmm. I did not know my father. I was only an infant when he died. So our experience will be a little different. I go back and forth about, would my life have been better if I would have had 6 years on earth with my dad and then he was taken from me? Or is it better that he was taken from me without me even knowing him?
Tell us about these Facebook posts, because you got to know about this officer, Stephen Deaton, through something that happened pretty recently. And I guess you could say it was kind of creepy, the stuff that he was posting online. Can you describe what you found?
When I Googled him back in 2014, I saw that he had a lot of media coverage. He was always, seemed like he was always in the media for something, whether it was leaving his gun at a local Target or he had an affair with like someone in his administrative office and was forced to step down. And so in all of those stories, it was kind of sad to not see my father mentioned that he had killed a man. And so I think it was around August of 2019, I was driving and I received a text from my mother and it was linked to an article. Basically, the headline was something along the lines of a local sheriff makes racist Facebook posts. And my mom's text to me was, isn't this the officer who killed your father? And my heart kind of just stopped in that moment. And I was on the road, and thank God I was able to get to a red light, because I was not at a place where I could drive. Like, every emotion that I had experienced since childhood kind of came over me in that moment. I was like scrolling through the article back and forth, and I saw like images of, it was a black football player figurine with his legs amputated. He was laying in a pool of blood and the American flag was hanging over him. And I automatically knew what that was about. That was about Colin Kaepernick's protest against police brutality. And the caption to that post was, this is what happens when you kneel during the national anthem. I just could not believe that the man who killed my father had a problem with protests of police brutality.
So this is a figurine, meaning like this is some sort of staged image of a football mm-hmm. player, I think, in the sort of staged pool of blood, right?
Right. Yeah. It was like a pre-made meme type of image. Mm-hmm. And so, it was like a little action figure and it was lying in a pool of blood with the American flag above him, and an elf, a white elf, was amputated the football player's legs. And that wasn't the only post. He also shared posts that kind of alluded to sexual assault and rape. Basically, it was like Barbie dolls, like bent over and kind of inappropriate positions. And then his caption, like they would have kind of vomit on the mouth. And his caption was something along the lines of a roofie was slipped in her drink or something along those lines. And so not only did you killed my father and you're making a racist post, but you're also, you know, kind of encouraging violence against women. I'm a woman. And so it was just very unsettling for me. And it's just so sad that this is a person who was trusted to protect our community. And it just made me think, like, who else has he hurt? Has he killed anyone else? Has he harmed anyone else? It was very, it definitely re-traumatized me.
Stephen Deaton, the man who shot your father, kind of went on to keep on advancing in his career. What became of him? What's his status now?
So the officer who killed my father, Stephen Deaton, was able to serve almost or more than 26 years at Austin Police Department, was able to rise to the rank of police chief, assistant police chief. And he eventually moved to Williamson County Sheriff's Office before he was forced to resign because of the racist Facebook posts he made. Mm-hmm. And so today, he could very well be a police officer again. As we speak, he could have found another department. He could be out in the field right now. So I don't know what he's doing now. But it is very concerning to me that he still is able to be a police officer.
And just to wrap up, Monique, you know, it seems like all these conversations we're having are only because of so much loss and pain and tragedy. And there is this conversation about, you know, how do we do this in a way that is not just voyeuristic, I suppose, in a way, as a country, that's not just about staring at the latest viral video. How can we have the most productive conversation around all these terrible stories, like your own father's and your family's?
Right. I think that's a very powerful point, and I think that's exactly what I'm living through. It took another Black man's death at the hands of law enforcement for me to even share my story and my father's death, and that really, I've been having some internal battles with that. And I wished that this industry could, as many stories like mine as there are, because there's tons of them, I wish we could shine a light on as many of them as we can without there being riots or violence or burning buildings. I wish that we could, you know, tell these stories before, stories of Black men and their experiences with law enforcement, Black women and their experiences with law enforcement before they die. I wish we could tell the stories of children in Black communities who are scared of law enforcement, who haven't necessarily even lost a loved one, but just from conversations with family members in their homes about law enforcement and are even scared when officers drive by. I wish we could tell those stories. But I will say that I'm happy that I was able to tell my father's story and I accomplished my goal. But what keeps me up at night is all the children out there who never will be able to tell their parents' story. And so I've kind of made that my purpose and my lane in this field, is to share those stories of the family members of victims of police brutality and how it's affected them their whole lives and how it will continue to affect them for the rest of their lives.
Montanique Monroe is a freelance photojournalist based in Austin, Texas. Montanique, thank you so much for sharing your story.
Thank you, Arun.
Amber Ruffin has been a Black writer in mostly white spaces for much of her career. But her success has led to opportunities to make her own spaces and make them as Black as she wants.
Nothing feels better than being like, which Babyface song? Not that one, the other one. It's the feeling of writing without weights.
I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America for a conversation with comedian Amber Ruffin. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Throughout his administration, President Trump has continued to place immigration at the forefront of his policies. And in this, he found an unlikely ally.
We've had a tremendous relationship over the last 2 years on the border. We've signed agreements with Guatemala that have been tremendous in terms of really both countries, but our country with respect to illegals coming into our country. We just can't have it. And it's been very much slowed up. Guatemala's been terrific.
Guatemala's former president Jimmy Morales cozied up to Trump from the start of Trump's presidency. And now a new investigation from Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting shows that there's credible suspicions for a quid pro quo between Morales and President Trump, where Morales agreed to a U.S. immigration policy in exchange for the U.S.'s support in ousting an anti-corruption commission and its top official. This former top official, Ivan Velasquez, used to be at the head of the International Commission Against Impunity in Guatemala, also known as CICIG. CICIG initially received funding and support from the U.S. government to do away with corruption in the country. But last year, when CICIG began investigating allegations against Morales, the anti-corruption body was shut down. And now Ivan Velasquez is alleging that the U.S. government helped support the shuttering of the commission in exchange for support from Guatemala for the Safe Third Country Agreement, a policy to stop migration flows to the U.S. I spoke with Aniancy Diaz-Cortez, a reporter and radio producer with Reveal, who helped break down this alleged quid pro quo.
What Ivan Velasquez alleges that in exchange for getting the commission and him ousted out of Guatemala threateningly, Ivan Velasquez says, look at the reality of what Trump got an exchange. Like, you don't need me to allege it. Look at the reality. After there's Jeeps circling the CC offices, shortly after we see kind of a blossoming relationship between Morales and Trump, right after Iván Velásquez is taken out, you see that Trump gets an open door policy into Guatemalan migration policy.
And what was the result of that migration policy for people who kind of forget what happened?
The result of that migration policy, as you know, is basically that before people coming from El Salvador, Honduras, before they can go up north to claim asylum in the U.S., they have to claim asylum in Guatemala. And what this effectively does, it states that Guatemala is a safe third country. And what that means is that it's safe for immigrants to claim asylum. But our question throughout this whole time was like, if this is a safe country, then why in 2019 did 280,000 Guatemalans get deported from the southwest U.S. border back to Guatemala? If it's so safe, why are people fleeing in the hundreds of thousands every single year?
So let's go back to the roots of this situation, or at least to the roots of this new anti-corruption commission that was established in Guatemala and was championed by the previous administration and Vice President Joe Biden. When was it put in place and why?
Arun, the thing to understand here is that it was put in place in the early 2000s, and it was seen as a kind of reckoning between the United States and Guatemala after decades of civil war, where through the Cold War and since 1954, we know well-documented U.S. involvement in support of merciless military dictatorships that went on to commit genocide. And this was all supported by the U.S. When the peace accords get signed in 1997, not to go too into the weeds, Bill Clinton goes to Guatemala and apologizes. And he's like, this is a new beginning. And so the CICIG, this anti-corruption commission, is kind of set up as a reckoning to be like, okay, let's do the, what are the root causes of migration? Why do people continue to want to come? Because when you live in a failed state, when you live in a place rife with corruption, where you can't go to the cops, where there's no access to like medical care, where there's no accountability for those in power, the logical place is like you look north, you look to the north where you can make a life for yourself, where mm-hmm. you can have hope in the future, right? So this commission was set up to do like the very boring labor of institution building, of investigating, of making the link between corruption and people in power, right? And it was a success. It started under Bush, you know, and it was funded by the U.S. So it was U.N. appointed, funded by the U.S. with the support of the Guatemalan Congress. So you needed this kind of dream team approach where everyone was working together, where this commission could make recommendations, but they had to be implemented by Guatemalan Congress, and the money came from the U.S.
And Nancy, what exactly happened when Iván Velásquez, the head of CICIG, caught wind of the alleged corruption from Morales and his family?
Velásquez catches wind that there's some fraud going on with these receipts and these checks that were never cashed, and it involves the president's family. He calls Jimmy Morales out. Jimmy Morales accepts this, goes on national television, condemns impunity, but obviously that's not enough for Velásquez. Velásquez wants Jimmy Morales to stand before a judge. And this is where the rift really starts to happen. It was the beginning of the end, in some ways, of the commission in Guatemala. And when you ask Velásquez why go after them, his response is, if the law isn't for the powerful, if the law is only there for the dispossessed, then is it law, right? So his stance is very, the law is
purist.
The law is the law. Yes,
yeah, I mean, purist. In some ways, when I read this fact that this very powerful independent prosecutor is willing to go after what is clearly a crime, but also involves several thousand dollars. We're not talking about a massive amount of corruption. It did initially strike me as, does this guy understand how to navigate power, or is he going to sort of prove to be partly his own undoing?
I mean, that's exactly the right analysis, Arun, because, I mean, he went got into a lot of hot water for not being able to kind of handle politically the situation of like who to go after and how. I think his perspective is he went after like rings of corruption where like you would pull on one thread and then the $11,000 led to like a larger kind of campaign finance situation with Morales, and he would keep on pulling that way. But in terms of like the stakes of this led to basically the commission being squashed. You know, was it worth it? And we asked him, and his stance is the rule of law. Basically, this is what he says is his calling. But at this point in the story, Morales starts to really send signals and do lobbying efforts from Guatemala to the U.S. to kind of curry favor with the Trump administration and be like, hey, you have Robert Mueller. Right around the same time, Robert Mueller was investigating Trump. Velasquez talks about this conversation that his staff people told him about, where it was like, you have Robert Mueller, I have Ivan Velasquez. We share, you know, we share the same suffering in some ways, you know? So,
yeah. So you have this sort of nexus between the American president and the Guatemalan president. For Morales, as he kind of starts pushing back against this anti-corruption effort in his country, how was this playing out nationally? I mean, did you have a base there that was really rallying around him, or was it seen as his interference with a very necessary system of anti-corruption crusaders?
I mean, you had, you know, what you do have, and like, you know, you do one Google search and it's like, when you follow this timeline of like the persona non grata, and then when he eventually gets kicked out, I mean, what the CC was for you have civil society on the street protesting in support of Velasquez, and what you created, you know, is kind of the beginnings of a culture of like rule of law and accountability. And he was strongly supported. The CC was strongly supported by civil society within Guatemala. No, but I think just the persistence of Velasquez to continue what some would call like a fixation of going after Morales and like not backing down, ends up, what ends up happening is that, you know, after the embassy of Guatemala moves to Jerusalem, after the U.S. embassy moves as well, after Nikki Haley goes to Guatemala and is like, Velasquez, tone it down, like, stop it with the I Heart CC bumper stickers, chill out on the press conferences, like, you know, the FBI doesn't make the paper every day, like, you need, you know, and then it went from there to, like, you're affecting the business in Guatemala, you're affecting the sovereignty of Guatemala. There was, like, a slow asphyxiation that was happening of the CC while this campaign in Washington was brewing around Ivan Velasquez and the CC being an arm of Vladimir Putin and Ivan Velasquez being a Russian agent. Now, this sounds fringy, Arun, but hold on a second. This thinking makes it to the pages of the Wall Street Journal, and it makes it to the halls of Congress around this time. So there's like Chris Smith, there's people in Congress advocating to end the CC because they believe that it is an arm of Russia and that Ivan Velasquez is a Russian agent, right? So we asked Ivan Velasquez this, if he was a Russian agent, and, you know, in his own words, he's never been to Russia. He doesn't have communications with any Russians. It hasn't been proven that he has connections to Russia. But this thinking makes it to Congress and is kind of the foundation that the U.S. uses to pull support, to pull financial support, only $10 million supporting this commission. This is what they use to pull the plug, like the justification for this commission not to continue.
And what is the benefit as you see it? Because it's not only Republicans like Marco Rubio who come out, you know, with this kind of elevated scrutiny of CICIG and what's happening in Guatemala. It's also, there are some Democrats as well, right? It's like there's this kind of like dark cloud that suddenly hangs over this foreign policy effort.
I mean, it was a bipartisan effort from the beginning to support it. And in pulling the plug, it was also a bipartisan effort. I think what happens is that there's a huge lobbying support in taking out the CC and saying, okay, they had their turn, let Guatemalan civil society take over. And that's what CC was intended for, was for, you know, Guatemalans to take ownership of their own judicial system. So in January of this year, Jimmy Morales left office, and there was, you know, since CC was kicked out of the country, we've kind of seen a return to the way things used to be. Guatemala's new president, Alejandro Llamate, has deep ties to drug mafias and former military officials. He used to oversee the prison system, and CICIG even went after him for illegally killing prisoners. So why would you let in a commission that has already gone after you? And since he took office, 12 human rights defenders have been killed in Guatemala and others have fled the country. So there is a return, and the CICIG building, like the physical building, is scheduled to be demolished this year.
Anayansi Diaz-Cortez is a reporter and radio producer with Reveal. Anayansi, thank you so much for your reporting.
Thanks, Arun. So good to be here.
Tomorrow marks the 19th anniversary of the 9/11 terror attacks, and all these years later, there's a lot you may not know about the road to that day. But a new 8-episode podcast from WNYC Studios and History called Blind Spot, The Road to 9/11, aims to make sense of the decades of global events and foreign policy decisions leading up to that day, and how, in many cases, the U.S. missed or outright ignored obvious signs. For example, the decision to fund Afghanistan's Mujahideen and to send the CIA to train their soldiers to fight invading forces of the Soviet Union in the 1980s would later come back to haunt us.
It turned Afghanistan into the Harvard Business School of Jihad, where students learn the latest lessons about mounting an insurgency, and where a great deal of personal networking led to dynamic future partnerships. As in the most famous example of all blowbacks, which was gestating at this very moment. It involved a rich Saudi who'd studied economics and emerged from the Afghan war a hero to some in the Muslim world. Osama bin Laden.
That's a clip from the first episode of Blind Spot, The Road to 9/11. The first two episodes are now available on iTunes or wherever else you get your podcasts. And the voice you heard there is Jim O'Grady, a WNYC reporter and colleague, and the host of Blind Spot, The Road to 9/11. Jim, great to have you here.
Same, Arun. It's great to be here.
All right, Jim. So it's been 19 years. Why do we need to look back at The Road to 9/11 now?
Yeah, on the day, I was living in Staten Island, and I rushed down to the waterfront. I was a reporter for the New York Times and stood there with a bunch of other people watching the buildings burn, trying to figure out what we were seeing. It was just so deeply disorienting. And I remember a woman nearby said kind of quietly, "The chickens have come home to roost," quoting Malcolm X. And I'm sure she was not saying the United States is to blame for this attack. I think what she was getting at is there are large forces at play here. She just had that sense. And that's what we've been trying to figure out for 19 years. Shortly after the attacks, when nearly 3,000 people have died, we're not so interested in looking at the intricacies of the United States' role in global foreign policy and propping up governments in Arab countries that extremists like Osama bin Laden object to. But now we can do that. And we take some of that larger, longer view in this story. Now we can explain the way the Afghan war, which raged in Afghanistan throughout the 1980s, was the perfect opportunity funded by the CIA for these radical jihadists to get to know each other. And we trace the connections and the meetings and re-meetings that they have from the end of the Afghan war through the decade of the 90s until that morning of 9/11.
So who did you speak to for this project?
We did this in partnership with History, formerly known as the History Channel, and we worked off a video documentary that they aired a few years ago, and their giant and impressive pile of 60 interviews with insiders, people from the CIA, the FBI, the White House at the time, a mujahideen who slept on the ground with Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan and knew him for years, a mujahideen whose father, by the way, was a very influential preacher and would come to Brooklyn and raise money for the cause, and who was later mysteriously assassinated in a bombing. And who was involved in the debate about the forming of Al-Qaeda and in what direction it would take and whether it would attack the West. So we talked to people who were there and who made these decisions that propelled this story and brought us to 9/11.
What were some of the most surprising things you learned about the road to 9/11, given that, you know, after 9/11, for years really, we saw those images play over and over and over again, to the point of either being numbed or I think traumatized, especially if you're really connected to it. What do you think all these years of distance have allowed you to see in that story that we didn't see early on?
Well, just how provisional it was. It didn't have to happen. There were plots going on that led up to 9/11. In 1993, the World Trade Center was bombed, and some of those people had associations with other people. Some of the funding came from Osama bin Laden. In 1998, the U.S. embassies in Tanzania and Nairobi were bombed, and the U.S. ineffectively lobbed cruise missiles at bin Laden, and in some parts of the Arab world, he became a hero. In the few years after that, we go into this in sort of crazy detail. The CIA felt like it had 9 different shots where they could kill or kidnap Osama bin Laden, and none of them were taken for reasons of politics, or they weren't sure that the mission could go down and successfully. All of the people in play that led up to this, all of the sort of intelligence failures that allowed 9/11 to happen, and also the successes, we tell the story of a major plot that would have killed thousands of people in New York City, the Landmarks plot, and how it came so close to happening, if not for an undercover agent who exposed it in the nick of time. So all of these sort of forgotten or untold stories, I was surprised all along the way while I was doing the research for this series.
I've been listening to the podcast and absolutely loving it, loving the insights you bring, but also just the characters, these kind of crazy background characters, informants, bit players, some of them, but also the character of New York City itself, which is a very different place in 1990 when you kind of begin your story, wasn't it?
Yeah, I lived through New York City in 1990. I knew that there was a crime wave going on. I had forgotten that there were these sort of liberationist groups and sectarian groups from around the world that were bombing Manhattan embassies and various political sites to get attention for their causes. And it created this sort of busy chaos and sort of chronic violence in New York City that in a way caused a smokescreen. It was hard to understand which was the petty bombing and which was the bombing or the assassination. Is that the thing that's connected to a worldwide network that's going to grow and progress toward 9/11? Or is that bombing over there? Is that the real threat? So it was a tremendous difficulty for law enforcement at the time. And we follow in their footsteps as they try to puzzle this out, this new threat. How significant it is or it isn't, who's behind it, why, and how to stop it. So that's the New York City that gives rise to this story. New York City was a locus for this kind of organizing of terror cells that would go on to do great damage.
Jim O'Grady is a WNYC reporter and the host of Blind Spot, The Road to 9/11. Jim, thanks so much.
Thank you, Arun. Always good to talk to you.
And that's our show for today. Thanks so much for listening. And a quick shout out to the team that helps make this show happen. Our board operator this week is Debbie Daughtry, with Vince Fairchild directing the show. Alexandra Botti is our senior producer, and her crew are Jackie Martin, Jose Olivares, Ethan Oberman, Jason Tureski, Meg Dalton, and Lydia McMullen-Laird. Pauly Irungu is our digital editor, David Gable is our executive assistant, and Lee Hill is the executive producer. Amy Walter is with you tomorrow. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Arun Vanigopal, in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.